This New York Times podcast is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features 911 assist to give you peace of mind. If your airbag deploys, Sync automatically calls 911 using your cell phone and immediately puts you in contact with a 911 operator. Sync is a system that's subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with science writer Annie Murphy-Paul about her new book, Origins.
Our traits and characteristics as children and even as adults are influenced by our 9 months in the womb.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. The great Gay Talese is here to talk about the art of nonfiction narrative.
And so I'm reading this, these great writers of fiction, and I'm wondering what could I borrow from them or steal from them or be inspired about their work to the degree of instilling that into the sports writing.
And Gregory Coles has bestseller news. The smarter and more knowledgeable we think we're getting, the less we actually know about the most fundamental things. There's an important new book. It's called Origins: How the 9 months Before Birth Shaped the Rest of Our Lives. It's by Annie Murphy-Paul. It's reviewed on our cover by Jerome Groopman, who calls it an informative, wise new book and says Paul provides a balanced, common-sense view of an emerging field of uncertain science. I'm delighted that Annie Murphy-Paul is here to talk about her book. Welcome, Annie.
Nice to be here.
Okay, birth pangs, we call it in our headline. You actually cover the 9 months of gestation and birth. How did you come to write this book?
Well, as a science writer, I became very interested in this emerging science of fetal origins, this idea that our traits and characteristics as children and even as adults are influenced by our 9 months in the womb. And then I myself got pregnant. Each month of my own pregnancy, I explored a different prenatal influence, diet and nutrition, stress and trauma, chemical exposures, medications and drugs. And I spoke to the experts in the field, I delved into the research literature, and I observed my own feelings and actions and behaviors as a pregnant woman.
So here we have the oldest or close to oldest human activity, and there's really a lot we're just learning about it now, giving birth, that, you know, mortality rates are much better than they used to be, and people buy their baby Mozart genius, you know, DVDs, whatever they do. I mean, does all of this kind of reflect that we're just beginning to learn about this most basic thing?
In a way, it does. There's a lot that we're learning now. Fetal origins is exploding in terms of the literature that's available, the research that's going on right now. But on the other hand, the idea that we're shaped by events and experiences before birth is actually a very old idea, and one that we're just now remembering, having forgotten it for much of the 20th century when doctors and scientists thought that the fetus was, in their words, a perfect parasite, meaning that it could take whatever it needed from the woman's body and it didn't matter what the woman ate. They thought that the placenta was a perfect shield against environmental contaminants and also drugs, which we learned was not true at all in the thalidomide and DES tragedies. So most cultures in most times in world history have believed that there's an intimate and reciprocal relationship between the pregnant woman and the fetus. That's something that we forgot to our regret during much of the 20th century, and scientists are now sort of resurrecting that idea.
Well, because for the longest time, you know, if you watch old movies, you see it. You see these sort of glamorous pregnant women who are drinking martinis and smoking cigarettes, and then the baby pops out of the womb, mm-hmm. and it's a gorgeous child and goes on to lead the perfect life. Mm-hmm. But in fact, all these things we worry about so much now that sometimes are actually kind of mocked in the culture, right? The overparenting and all of that actually turn out to be sort of true then, right? Like what you eat.
Well, you raise the question of drinking and how pregnant women used to drink and smoke without really a second thought. And I have a section in Origins when I talk to the man who first named fetal alcohol syndrome, a doctor named Kenneth Jones. And I said, look, there's a whole generation of children who were born to mothers who drank during pregnancy, including me, and we all turned out fine. What do you say to that? And he said, well, are you sure you're fine? What could you have been if she didn't drink? So it's hard to say exactly what the effects of individual actions are during pregnancy, but we are certainly learning that what women do and eat and drink and even feel during pregnancy can have very long-lasting effects, much more long-lasting than we ever knew before.
Now, what about the scientists themselves? You spent a lot of time with a number of them. When did we start getting serious research, and what's some of that research like?
Well, about 20 years ago, a British doctor named David Barker noticed something strange on a map, which was that the poorest regions of Wales and England had the highest rates of heart disease. And this was puzzling because heart disease was supposed to be a disease of affluence, of too much rich food and a sedentary lifestyle. So Barker decided to look into this, and he discovered an unexpected connection between low birth weight, which is often an indication of poor prenatal nutrition, and heart disease in middle age, many decades later. And this went against everything that that cardiologists had believed about the roots of heart disease, which were supposed to be all about genes and adult lifestyle choices like smoking and diet. And when Barker introduced these findings at medical meetings, his colleagues jeered. They shouted him down. Some of them walked out of the room. So that was 20 years ago, and it was a long fight for Barker to achieve some measure of legitimacy, but because his results have been replicated many times now by many different scientists, many of them are in the heart of the mainstream of the medical establishment, we're finally coming around to the idea that his idea wasn't so crazy after all, that fetal conditions, intrauterine conditions, can really exert effects for many years and even decades after birth.
Okay, so you're accumulating all this important, sometimes complex and arcane information while you're pregnant. So how did this affect what you did in the course of those 9 months? Or are there two or three things mm-hmm. you did differently from mm-hmm. what you might have done before? Mm-hmm. Or did you just, in a general way, kind of know all the right things to do?
Oh, no. I went into this with a fair amount of uncertainty and apprehension and the kind of anxiety that accompanies many pregnancies these days. But in the course of researching and reporting this book, I came to feel quite differently. I mean, I did change some concrete things. I ate a lot more fish, making sure that it was not high mercury varieties. I exercised. These are things that I hadn't done in my first pregnancy, but I did do after reading the research in my second pregnancy. I ate a lot of chocolate, which is turns out to be associated with a happier infant temperament and a lower risk of preeclampsia, which is a high blood pressure condition in pregnancy. And I didn't worry about the moderate stress that I experienced. I learned in my research that very severe stress can have a harmful effect on the baby, but that moderate stress actually accelerates the development of the nervous system, leading to smarter babies. So those were some practical things that I did, but I also developed an entirely different kind of attitude about pregnancy. I had taken on, in my first pregnancy, this sort of general societal anxiety about pregnancy, wherein you're afraid every moment that you're doing something to harm your fetus. But I came to think of it very differently as a pregnancy as a positive, proactive kind of shaping of the fetus before he's even born. Before he's in the world, he's already receiving hints and cues from the mother and from her world about the particular kind of place he's going to arrive in. So talking to fetal origin scientists who are on the cutting edge of this work, and they were not full of dire warnings about what I should and shouldn't do during pregnancy. They were full of excitement about the discoveries they were making and the potential these discoveries had to improve the health and well-being of a new generation.
Thanks a lot, Annie.
Thank you.
That's Annie Murphy-Paul, whose new book, Origins, How the 9 Months Before Birth Shaped the Rest of Our Lives, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So kids are into ebooks too. What a surprise.
Yes, shocking. Scholastic has released the results of a study that it did earlier this year. Scholastic is, of course, the publisher of the Harry Potter books and more recently the Hunger Games trilogy by Suzanne Collins. So they commissioned a study to find out kids and parents' attitudes on technology and how it affects their reading for fun. One of the things they found is that about a quarter of the children who were surveyed said they had already read an ebook, and that includes a book on a computer or an e-reader like the Kindle. But 57% of them said that they were interested in doing so. So this seems to indicate that there's a lot of potential for ebooks in kids.
Do we know what age range we're talking about for this survey?
They talked to, I believe, about 1,000 kids between the ages of 6 and 17, and they also talked to their parents. And parents were unsurprisingly very hesitant about the impact of technology on their kids' reading habits. A lot of parents said that they thought that cell phones, video games, television all took away from time that their kids spend reading. But a lot of the parents also said that to successfully get their kids to read for fun, all that they had to do was limit their time on TV and video games and also keep interesting books around the house to read. So very intuitive.
Are we talking about focus groups and marketing, or is this really a higher level of investigation and polling?
Somewhere in between. You know, this wasn't a multi-year study on children and parents. This was about 2,000 people total for the study. They talked to them earlier this spring, and they didn't really make a great effort to compare what this means versus a couple of years ago and how habits have changed over time. So it's a snapshot.
Do we have any idea, or do they, have they said what the classroom implications might be? Is this a way to help slow or reluctant readers? Is there an educational component to this?
There is a small one. I mean, one thing that came out of this study was that 9 out of 10 kids said that they would read a lot more for fun if they could choose the books that they're reading. And that really dovetails with a lot of educational trends right now. A lot of teachers, educators are saying that they find that not having a planned curriculum, okay, this is the book you're reading, now you're going to do a book report, and everyone in the class does the same book at the same time. That approach seems to be a little prehistoric at this point. A lot of teachers are moving away from that, and the study seemed
book
to confirm
review.
That that's the right move.
If you're going to say to kids, all right, you can read the book you want, is there some way for teachers to establish, you know, levels of difficulty, complexity, literary value, and merit, or are those issues also going to be set aside?
I'm getting a little in the weeds of educational theory here, but I know that a lot of the work that's coming out of Teachers College right now really indicates that the best way for children to learn is to move at their own pace within the same classroom. So the idea of, you know, sending a kid, dividing children up into groups according to their own reading level is really not considered the best way to go anymore, that children can move at their own pace within the same classroom.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
This New York Times podcast is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features 911 Assist. If ever your airbag deploys, Sync automatically calls 911 using your cell phone. Bypassing call centers, you're immediately put in contact with a 911 operator. And Sync will even deliver an urgent message to the emergency operator if you're unable to respond. That's peace of mind made possible by Sync. Sync is a system that's subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
At the age of 78, Gay Talese remains one of the giants of nonfiction writing in America. He was also, some will be surprised to learn, a brilliant sports writer, many of whose pieces appeared in the New York Times long ago. Gay Talese recently visited the Times, and he and I talked about the art of sports writing and the art of nonfiction writing as well. So, Gay, I'm going to ask you about the very interesting introduction you've written about how you came to discover a form of nonfiction writing and how it was really inspired by some great fiction writers of your youth.
Yes. The first writers that I came to read, of course, was the period when I came to New York in the 1950s. My first job was a copy boy in the New York Times. This was in 1953. And I worked for the Times for about 8 months, called in the Army for a couple years, returned in 1956, got a job in the sports department. And the sports editor was a man named Ray Kelly, but there was a sub-editor there, Frank Blunt. He was the assistant. And he liked me, and he let me do features. And I interviewed such people as Frank Gifford, who was a young football player with the New York Giants. And I interviewed some prize fighters, one of them named Jose Torres, the other named Floyd Patterson. Parenthetically, I met Norman Mailer at some of these fights. This is 1956, 57. Mailer was a great boxing fan. So was George Plimpton. So was Bud Schulberg. But I did start reading The New Yorker, and I came upon some wonderful writers. Principal among them was Irwin Shaw. There was John O'Hara. And I'd start reading collections of short stories as well. And I came upon Carson McCullers in a collection.
And Gay, Carson McCullers, our listeners will remember, that's the member of The Wedding. This is a great Southern fiction writer.
Yes, indeed. From Columbus, Georgia. And but I only read this story in an anthology of short stories called The Jockey. And when I read that story, and also mentioned I read The 80-Yard Run, and I read some of John O'Hara's things. And so I'm reading this, these great writers of fiction, and I'm wondering what could I borrow from them or steal from them or be inspired about their work to the degree of instilling that into the sports writing and profile writing in the sports department of the New York Times. And I was doing, to a degree, successfully, and to a degree, since it was a learning process, perhaps awkwardly.
Gay, what specifically did you find in these great fiction writers that you thought could be translated into sports writing?
The trouble with journalism sometimes is that the writer is remote from what he's writing about and keeps that distance and also does not delve into or deal with any thoroughness with the character of the character, the characterization of character. The short story writer, they of course create people. And in journalism, we do not, assiduously do not create anything. We are reporters. We are fact gatherers. We are proponents of realism and accuracy and verifiability as well as accuracy. I wanted to bring something of the storytelling technique done by these wonderful short story writers or fiction writers. First of all, it's describing people, what they look like. Describing situations in which they are involved, sometimes the conflict or the interaction between characters, such as the dialogue that ensues. And more important, if you know the people well enough, and I took not only a lot of time with the people I interviewed, but I go back and back again. One of the persons I interviewed when I was a sports writer, 57 and 58, was Floyd Patterson. I think I interviewed him more than 30 times. I had 30 separate articles. And in the process of seeing him that often, I would see changes in his life. He would tell me one thing one year, and a couple years later, it'd be a little different as his life was made different by events outside of his control. With his control, he lost fights. He had trouble with his wife. Whatever it was, I would see the emerging character. And after all, what fiction writers have over nonfiction writers is they can see change in their situation. Their characters can grow. Their characters are altered by circumstances. Whereas in nonfiction, or certainly in journalism, daily journalism, it might be a disaster, it might be a fire, it might be a shooting, it might be some kind of event that is unexpected. And the reporter is on the scene and off the scene, and that's the end of it. In general reporting, and then in sports reporting to a degree, you don't know the people well enough, or you know them from the press box. You know them from a kind of on the sidelines of their life. I was able to see them in their homes and see them when they were not performing. I had cultivated our relationship to the point where I could be trusted to be in their private lives. And I reflected that. And therefore, I was moving into the world of fiction, because fiction writes about private life. Journalism tends to write about public life, public figures. And I wanted to do what McCullers did so well in writing about a jockey, or Irwin Shaw did so well in writing about a football player from a Midwestern college. And so the influence of fiction was enormously important to me and shaped my ambition
Well, speaking of which, Gay, we have the extraordinary title story, The Silent Season of a Hero. Our reviewer, Gordon Marino, says many believe this is the greatest piece of sports writing in American history. It's a profile of Joe DiMaggio long after his retirement. Tell us how that story came to be written.
I was born in 1932, and in the war years, I was 10, 12. Not only was it Italy at war, but my father had two or three brothers in the Italian army fighting the Americans, and I was I wasn't very comfortable with being who I was because I wasn't sure who I was. As a young American in this particular setting, my hometown, DiMaggio was one of the few men with an Italian name that didn't bring dishonor upon the government or the nation of the United States. We had mafia men who were in the news all the time, you know, from Al Capone to Frank Costello. Those were the same era of the 30s or 40s. DiMaggio was one of the few Italian Americans that didn't bring disgrace upon this nation. And we Italian Americans, young Mr. Cuomo, back in the 40s, we all had a little bit of sensitivity, if not defensiveness, about who we were, where we came from. And so DiMaggio was a real example of what was possible. Now, when I came, I told you this be a sports writer, DiMaggio's days were over. But I had a friend who's a photographer on the New York Times. He took some of the pictures when I was writing for the sports section. His name was Ernest Sisto, S-I-S-T-O. And I went once to an Old Timers Day game. And I was in the locker room and I saw Ernie Sisto. This was in 1966. I'd left the Times a year before, 65. But I knew Sisto very well. He said, oh, Joe's here. Would you like to meet Joe? He introduced me to DiMaggio. And it was that time I said, well, yeah, I'd like to come out and write about you sometime. And DiMaggio seemed to be amenable. And a year later, I did go out there.
Out there to San Francisco.
Yeah, he was then living in San Francisco. Well, of course, he lived all his life in San Francisco. But DiMaggio was not very happy to see me. I wrote him, but I thought my letters were read by him, but he didn't open them. And I learned this when I arrived unannounced at the restaurant he owned. And so he really was upset, and I was invading his privacy, and he all but threw me out. But I finally did. I did make my connection with him. All journalists must be patient. I was certainly patient. I stayed in San Francisco, and I approached a man, another old sports figure named Lefty O'Dool. And I told Lefty O'Dool that DiMaggio wanted to meet him. I wasn't out there to invade his privacy and talk about Marilyn Monroe and all that.
Which he feared. I mean, he told you very directly.
He thought I was trying to, you know, what happened? She was dead now, you see. And, of course, there were the rumors that she'd been involved romantically with this person, with a Kennedy here and someone else there. And DiMaggio was, I'm sure, a little bit upset about this if it was true. And secondly, didn't want to discuss it even if it was not true. He just didn't want anything like that. And he didn't know what my approach was. And Esquire, he thought, and many still did, was sort of a little trashy magazine. Before Playboy, Esquire was a little racy magazine. It had Hemingway and John Dos Passos and John Steinbeck, and there were a lot of contributors. But it also had this little pinup girl, and it was always nicely featured. And maybe DiMaggio, who was a bit of a prude, maybe he was picking up on that. Well, the Esquire, who wants to be an Esquire? Anyway, I finally did, through the help of Lefty O'Dool, who invited me to go to around the golf course not a caddy, but just as a follower. Because DiMaggio and O'Dool played a lot of golf in Napa Valley Country Club outside of San Francisco.
And they were pretty good.
They were very good. And there's another old football player named Ernie Nevers who was part of their foursome. And so I went out one day to follow them on the golf course. And so when DiMaggio hit a couple balls into the rough, I was lucky to find them. And he was very pleased at this. I mean, he didn't like to lose golf balls. Few people do. Well, I got the blessing of DiMaggio after that. It was really a very important thing in our relationship, my finding golf balls. And I would later on spend some time with him. And I wrote this piece that you referred to.
Gay, something we haven't discussed that's so important in all your writing, including your sports writing, is just the prose itself. Why don't you read for us the opening of the extraordinary profile you wrote of Joe DiMaggio?
It was not quite spring. The silent season before the search for salmon. And the old fishermen of San Francisco were either painting their boats or repairing their nets along the pier, or sitting in the sun talking quietly among themselves, watching the tourists come and go, and smiling now as a pretty girl paused to take their picture. She was about 25, healthy and blue-eyed and wearing a red turtleneck sweater. She had long, flowing blonde hair that she brushed back a few times before clicking her camera. The fishermen, looking at her, made admiring comments, but she did not understand because they spoke a Sicilian dialect. Nor did she notice the tall, gray-haired man in the dark suit who stood watching from behind a big bay window on the second floor of DiMaggio's restaurant, which overlooked the pier. He watched her until she left, lost in the crowd of newly arrived tourists that had just come down the hill by cable car. Then he sat down again at the table in the restaurant, finishing his tea and lighting another cigarette, his fifth in the last half hour. Now that refers to DiMaggio, and that's how that piece begins.
Thanks so much, Gay Talese.
Thank you.
That's Gay Talese, whose new book, The Silent Season of a Hero, The Sports Writing of Gay Talese, is reviewed in this week's book review. To hear more of my conversation with Gay Talese, visit our website at nytimes.com/books. Gregory Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
So it's the return of the series novels.
Yeah, this week on the fiction list, there are four new books, and they all come from series. The first one, Bad Blood by John Sanford, is part of this Minnesota thriller series that he does. We also have Sophie Kinsella's Mini Shopaholic. She does a series about this woman, Becky Brandon, who is into high-end luxury goods. Now she's trying to plan a surprise birthday party for her husband on a budget.
Signs of the times.
Exactly. Guillermo del Toro, the movie director behind Pan's Labyrinth, is back with the second book in his vampire series, The Strain. The second book is called The Fall. It's about a war between vampires. Stuart Woods brings together the heroes of two different series in his new book, Santa Fe Edge. There's a Santa Fe lawyer and a CIA agent who used to be in two different series and gathered it together in this book.
How about nonfiction?
Well, Jon Stewart is at the top of the nonfiction list with his new satire, Earth. It's a lot like his last satire, America, the book, but with more charts.
And the first one was a big bestseller, right?
The first one was a big bestseller, and this one promises to be as well. Jimmy Carter's new book, White House Diary, about his years as president, is new on the list at number 5. It seems like pretty much everything this guy writes makes the list at some point or other. As ex-presidents go, Dwight Garner once called him the Joyce Carol Oates of ex-presidents. And Ingrid Betancourt, who became famous as a hostage in Colombia, is new on the list at number 6 with her memoir of her time in captivity called Even Silence Has an End. It's not the first book about that captivity to hit the list. Last year, three of her American fellow hostages came out with a book called Out of Captivity, in which they really attacked her as aloof and selfish during their time in captivity, said that she didn't play well with the other hostages. She refused to be identified by a number. When the other hostages were all assigned numbers, she said, no, you have to call me by name. And she really used her fame and family prominence to try to establish herself as the alpha dog. Now she has her own say, and she is being more gracious in interviews and saying that no one behaved well all the time there, but they had nice moments together, too.
And that book's been pretty well received, right?
It's been very well received. It's supposed to be remarkably well written. There's some question how much of it is true. She also has antagonized some Colombians because she asked the Colombian government for millions of dollars in exchange for her emotional suffering. And so the Christian Science Monitor ran an article suggesting that Colombians might boycott the book as a result of that demand.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.